Cool. All right. I also have to figure out what question I'm going to ask you first.
Oh shit, the tension is mounting already.
Yeah, I'm not
The
going to tell you until
interrogation
I
has
get there.
begun.
All right. Welcome to Green Space. They were interviewing and chatting with Mike Correo. Mike is a writer, editor, designer, artist. And all of these words could have commas between them or hyphens because it seems often that these roles get a bit slippery or blurred in a lot of the ways that Mike kind of operates around books and text objects in these various roles. Work often has a strong attention to forms of digital materiality, the book object, and often remapping biological functionality onto the codex. So all these create interlinked systems of production, consumption, creation, and excretion. He's the author of numerous books, including Smut Maker, Mancer, Gut Text, Underreef, and many others. Just a really prolific writer. Also, the editor of Cloak, which is an interdisciplinary publishing project focused on visibility, concealment, and surveillance. Hello, Mike.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay, so the first question that we wanted to ask you is how do you access meaning or meaningfulness in your daily life? Just kind of a big open
Yeah.
starting
So
point.
I tend to interact with a lot of varied media, like a lot of books and music and articles and videos and games and shows. I try to kind of anything that I can get my hands on, really. I find that there's a lot of minutiae in kind of these random bits that I tend to kind of hold on to and think about for a while. I'll write them down when I hear them, and kind of collecting all of those like morsels kind of builds up to these creative processes. It's kind of this initial gathering. I remember when you and I were working on Zero Excess. I mentioned to you that I had been really fixated on this video about how to cut every vegetable. Like it was just some like international test kitchen or whatever YouTube channel video of just some guy methodically going through every single like notable or worthwhile vegetable, whatever that might mean, and giving you these like detailed description of how to process it. And I would play it on repeat. And it sounds normal in the context when they talk about like, oh, it should have this pink hue or like the flesh should be tacky. But when you kind of like hold on to those phrases and take them out of that context and start reusing them, it gets really interesting to me. And so I'll find these videos, or music or like kind of audio in that same vein that really has almost nothing to do with anything I'm interested in or writing about, and have that kind of play on loop or as kind of part of a cycle, so I can like grab those phrases kind of seemingly at random as these kind of like almost interjections of automatic writing, maybe, kind of pulling those microscopic details and kind of recycling them in a sense. So maybe it's a good way to think of my books as kind of like a crude kind of like show and tell, like it's all the little trinkets that I've gathered over whatever period of time, and I'm kind of showing you. I have a kind of cursed Instagram kind of saved page, because you can save things on Instagram when you see them, that it'll be like a weird chair, like a tattoo of a wood carving, someone with a brass knuckles made out of like taxidermy birds, and like a wide skateboard, and I'll be like, I can use this for something, I know it. Like it's this kind of bizarre collaging out of various materials. I think that's how I get it out of like the daily life. It's just kind of like a background thing at this point. Like, I don't even think about doing it. It's just like I'll save something and I'll be like, I can use that later. Like, I don't really even think of it as part of the creative process. It's just like surrounding myself with this bizarre media.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think that is a good entryway to our next question. What would you like art, thought, or writing to do to you? And I'm interested in that cycling, that sort of like almost like tumbling or almost like you have those things that polish rocks and they bounce around and bounce around and bounce around. But
Yeah.
take it any way you want. Yeah, what would you like art, write, or thought to do to you?
Yeah, I like that idea of polishing. or maybe in a sense of just like that removal of excess, just to reduce it to some, not even central, but some kind of like isolated node, I think is a particularly kind of compelling focus point. But in terms of generally what I tend to like art that is either difficult, if it's in terms of like things like games where something like Dark Souls is classically mentioned, but something that's like really, there's a whole kind of task in front of you that seems hopeless. And I find that really compelling, as well as art that is kind of provoking some kind of pain or discomfort. I think that's an extension of this desire to get like a genuine reaction when I interact with a piece of art. And I think that genuine reaction, I want to be like visceral or kind of something that I'm not acclimated to. Like a piece of art that is like brings me like joy or makes me happy in like some kind of pure way, I'm like, I've felt happy and joy and I'm fine with that. But like the, when it provokes that discomfort, it like you have to sit in it. It makes it so like immediately tactile and like you're in the moment, because you, that discomfort isn't something you can kind of gloss over. And so I like art that kind of forces you into the like very present moment. Like you can't escape kind of duration. You have to kind of feel it. There's no kind of skimming through it.
Yeah, that's great. That sort of immediacy, right? Tactility, and that discomfort, I think, like you used kind of difficulty, discomfort, pain in this sort of like swirl of language. I think that discomfort in particular, I think like circulates really nicely between those. I'm also like very curious to think about, you know, when you're thinking about those categories, like, are those all your experiences? Are they directed experiences at others, right? We can think of some forms of like political art that are clearly directed forms of pain and discomfort, which also give you that visceral experience, even if it's not necessarily your own pain, right? The ability to deliver pain or violence, I think, is something that's embedded in certain types of art.
Yeah, I really like this idea of, well, I kind of in part find a certain comedy in like the pain on the side of the artist. Like it hurts me to make this thing. Like there's almost this kind of like this kind of sacrificial element to it, or ritual element, or like even self-harm kind of in the process. In your intro, you mentioned exorcism or expulsion, one of the two. And I like that kind of as a way to frame that process, is it's like, you're cutting something out. But in terms of the recipient or the user for like the kind of work of art, I like that discomfort in a certain political sense as a way to kind of avoid these kind of very commercialized, very capitalist kind of glossy works of art that are, they're kind of made to be these like marketable empty things. That, thinking of, I work during the day as like a book designer on a bunch of various things, and I'll get these projects that are like another memoir by like another tech corporation person, or like some business marketing, like self-help, like strategy book. And it's like this thing that's almost, it's a book that's not made to be read or engaged with in any meaningful way. It's almost there to be like shelf decoration for business people, in the same way that like Dostoevsky or Tolstoy is like shelf decoration for literary people. Like it's never meant to be engaged with, even by the people who make it. It's just to say like, I have this book, or I made this book. And so I like making these pieces that are hyper present and almost like working against you as a reader, in just showing you that kind of it's worth engaging with these pieces of art. Even if they're not kind of there to hold your hand, I think there's something worthwhile about that, about kind of that pain and discomfort. I think that people tend to avoid negative feelings because they're unpleasant, kind of just by nature. But I think it's really interesting and meaningful to kind of sit and engage with those, because not only do you learn more about yourself, but you kind of, I think you get more experience overall, that kind of sensory engagement that you're not really used to getting from outside.
Awesome. Yeah. So yeah, kind of looping, I guess this does go back into the intro stuff, but as you were kind of talking about the like expulsion or I think I talked mm-hmm. about like excreting things, right? We're talking about like these processes of eliminating waste in many ways. And I think there's like an interesting tension between thinking of these sort of artworks as these forms of excess. When we're talking about like the difficult is often pointed at, in this way, and also works that are engaging with or thinking through violence are often put into that kind of category as well. But at the same time, so do these products that you're talking about, these like, you know, like hyper-capitalist little consumer objects that are pure, like it is just pure waste, right? If you're talking about like someone making a book to just sit on a shelf to have it say something about themselves, right, that is a form of waste as well. So I'd be curious, and this is from a collection of these questions that we have from Paul Thek. For you, Mike, what is waste?
I think that waste is what doesn't get used. Everything going to like the landfill that doesn't get scavenged, all the data that gets collected and never used. I think recycling and compost are in part like kind of compelling ways to counter that and to turn things that are supposed to be waste into something that doesn't fit that label anymore, something with use. In practice, I think avoiding the materials and practices that bring us close to climate catastrophe, but maybe artistically and finding use out of those things that don't seem immediately useful or worthwhile. I know another one of your previous guests, Danica Stegman-LeMay, has talked to me about something she collects called interesting trash, quote unquote, is what she refers to it. And she'll gather things that she's going to get rid of or throw away and find a way to use those in her projects. And I like that kind of very material approach of taking literal waste in that case, something that wouldn't be composted or recycled, and applying some use to it. In kind of my more digital practice, I find myself gathering kind of data that wouldn't be used or is getting collected for no reason and finding ways to repurpose that. I remember a friend went to Italy for a semester abroad, and they would take the same route where they'd kind of leave where they were staying and they'd go to this cafe and then go to school and come back. And they had found that after 3 months of this, Google had been recording that exact path every day that they were taking. And it's not using that for any particular reason or kind of like collecting that maliciously, but there's just this way that you don't think about how like location data and things like this are getting shared. And when you have that active, it's getting recorded and stored somewhere. And so there's also this kind of more abstract or kind of less immediately physical kind of waste that I don't think we think about, or old web pages that are no longer in use, kind of this not immediately tactile, but still in a sense tactile, because all that information, even though it's kind of in the ether, is getting stored on a server somewhere. And I like to find ways to kind of reuse that waste in an artistic process, which I think is at times a kind of rickety bridge, because in trying to reuse digital waste, you're not really working with the original, you're creating a facsimile of that waste, you know, so you're in a sense adding more to the pile. So there's this kind of like moral dilemma I often run to, and it's like, should I even touch this data? But because by touching this data, I add more to the pile. Like just by documenting what exists, that document then adds to what exists. And so it's kind of one of those dilemmas that I run into that I don't think I necessarily have an answer for.
Yeah, I love that idea that reusing digital waste is in no way recycling. Yeah. But it's this proliferative process, or I mean, it is recycling it in one sense, but at the same time is proliferating it as well. I think that's fascinating. So yeah, you've been talking about sort of the constant automated production and of data. And so that leads me to our next question, which comes from a Bernadette Meyer letter to Bill Berkson in 1981. What do you think of machines, Mike?
I have to say first that I read probably an unnecessary amount of Bernadette Meyer leading up to this, since some of the questions are from her. I read something like 3 or 4 Bernadette Meyer books, and I was no more prepared for the question after having done it. But I think of machines as, it's really the only kind of toolbox I know how to kind of comfortably use. I'm not really one to handwrite beyond just like brief notes, or to paint or draw or do any of these kind of immediate kind of mechanically inclined kinds of art, sculpture, or anything like that. I've recently started doing furniture a little bit as this kind of hobby, but there's no real kind of hands-on art that I find myself kind of naturally comfortable doing in the same way as like digital or writing kind of work. So I think of them as a tool set more than as, I think recently with things like ChatGPT and like self-driving cars and all the AI art things, it maybe is getting kind of framed as this dystopian kind of potential, like it's going to replace everything I do, but we do, and like there's going to be no more artists, or like all of these jobs are going to be gone because of this. But I think that that takes away a certain accountability on behalf of the people who make these things. Like ChatGPT is operating by, you know, a set of constraints that it's been given by the person who made it. Or I remember during self-driving cars, like when those first coming up, there was this debate that was something like, if you are in a self-driving car and it hits someone, is it your fault or is it the car's? And when I'm asked that question, I think the answer is the person who programmed the car is the one that's at fault. They told the car what to do in that situation. And so I think it's important to remember that machines aren't autonomous systems, at least yet. Or if they are autonomous, they're autonomous based on a set of, you know, guidelines provided to them. And so I think to view machines as some kind of threat in and of themselves is not particularly kind of complete. It lacks that kind of who's the, you know, industrial tech despot, you know, pulling the strings on that. Who's the mad scientist? There's always someone kind of pulling the strings behind that object because it is just an object. There's always some subject looming behind it. But I've seen that to an extent, that kind of autonomy used in interesting ways. There's a game developer, an indie game developer who goes by Oleander Garden. Who has this game called Harlequin Fair, Hexcraft, and it has AI for the kind of non-player characters that operate on these kind of sets of desires and constraints and kind of logic paths that not even the game dev is really aware of. They're fully unpredictable to the point of seeming human. They lack so much logic that it's hard to believe it's a machine. And the dev is still, you know, responsible for that because they set off that initial chain and they cause that set of guidelines to go off. But I think it's really interesting to kind of leave after the incipient in that artistic space when, you know, it's not a large ethical question of who does this affect and more in that closed system. But I do think there are really interesting ways to use those kind of operations, kind of turning that like technical rational operation to this kind of occulted enigma.
Yeah, that's great. So thinking both of the computer, like right, as this sort of tool for production of a variety of different things, but also like you're kind of gesturing towards, right, these weird possibilities that are then starting to push more towards these sort of like speculative futures, right? And I think this is a zone that results in both a lot of apocalyptic thinking and a lot of conspiratorial thinking, which sort of leads to a question that we have, one of my favorites, which is, what's something you believe even though it's probably not true?
I think I rewrote my answer to this question so many different times because I believe it, so it has to be true. It's like this trap that you put me in. I think that maybe my best answer is that I have this inherent distrust of my own body, maybe as kind of extension of spending so much time in these very digital spaces. Like I'll hear it make a sound, or like I'll get some random bit of soreness, or like my stomach will make a weird noise, and I'm like, oh, this is it. I'm done for. Like, this is the end, but you know, I'm still here. So I don't know where that distrust completely spawns from. There was for a while this meme kind of floating around where it was like the two known enemies, the world and the flesh. And I really kind of like that a lot. It feels like it encapsulates that distrust that I shouldn't have. There's nothing really, you know, medically wrong with me that I'm aware of. But I do have this kind of constant concern that my body's conspiring against me. The kind of the mechanical kind of thing that the brain guides that I don't fully feel is me, but you know, it's the thing I'm piloting around, so I kind of got to get along with it to an extent. But I'm sure that's not the case, but I think it's the case.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, so thinking about your own mortality and your cranky flesh rig and entropy, what do you want your intellectual or artistic practice to look like in 20 years?
Oh, man. I think that it's kind of a reduction of what it is now would be really great. Right now, I'm kind of not spread thin, but kind of spread pretty far out. I do kind of book design as a day job, like I mentioned, and I do freelance work for a lot of presses like Phonograph Editions and Apocalypse Party and Inside the Castle, and running my own project Cloak. And so I think being able to reduce that practice to kind of just the things that I'm very incredibly kind of passionate about, both my own work and the things that I do at Cloak with authors like William Watson and Cynthia Hardwick and Danica, who was on here. If I could have an artistic practice, that's, I think it's everybody's dream to be like, I just want to make my art, you know, 8 hours a day and then be done, clock in, clock out. And to an extent, I'm lucky that I get to do something resembling that with, you know, the book design day job, although it's more kind of commercial or business, kind of nonfiction and things like that. I'm hoping that I can keep taking these kind of microscopic steps closer and closer until eventually I'm just only working on really weird shit all the time. I think that's maybe the summation of the dream, is to only work on weird shit all the time.
Yeah, that is the dream. I think that we all are projecting into our futures. So staying maybe in this realm of thinking through our hope for the future, and also to return to some of the thoughts of Bernadette Mayer. And this is from the list of journal ideas and writing experiments, and one that I think you have probably actually been thinking about a bit, especially with some of the work that you're trying to do in with Cloak. What do you see it as the poetry, writing, or medium of the future?
Okay, I got two bad ideas, and then I'll maybe go for a third one that's better. The first one is I want to see, like, the, you know, the square watermelons, they do like the molds that they can shape the watermelon. I want to see like an extension of that, of kind of like organically sourced non-GMO art, like grown out of whatever things. It almost makes me think of like that scene from Existenz where the gun is made out of like the fish bones that he kind of like eats at the restaurant. So I like the idea of like art that is grown, not in the kind of reductive way of saying like this weird shaped onion is a piece of art, but in having some kind of weird method for kind of growing art. Like I want to see like a turnip that's been grown in like the shape of the topology of like the Gobi Desert, or like a biblically accurate bulb of garlic, things like that, where it's like so almost like accursed organic objects would be really kind of interesting to see. And then it may be in a more writing sense, I recently learned about these things called Escher sentences, which are these sentences that at first seem like they make sense, and then as you kind of are lulled in, you realize that it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. The kind of the famous one is, more people have been to Berlin than I have, which you're like, oh yeah, that adds up. And it's like, but that actually doesn't mean anything, that more people have been. Like, you have to start kind of like putting up the cork board and connecting the threads and being like, this doesn't go anywhere. And so I like the idea of like some kind of writing like that in a longer form that is so like lulls you in so simply and so eagerly. And once you're in that kind of maze, you're like, nothing here makes sense. Like the staircase leads to the bottom floor, even though you're on the roof, and like, just there's kind of almost like a non-Euclidean form of writing that fully kind of entraps you in some way. Maybe more realistically, I'd like to see this kind of continuation of these more design or visual forward kind of like poetry and prose works. I think it's exciting to think of kind of a space that doesn't get labeled as either of these things. I think that, you know, fiction often is kind of reductive. I think poetry, you get a bit more room, but in fiction, it's a very kind of strict structure. And so I'm kind of interested in this space outside those two kind of very stiff labels. Some kind of like, not hybrid necessarily, but some kind of like secret third thing that I can make, because I don't like the idea of having to choose and be like, ah, yeah, it's a novel. That feels too simple for my hyperactive brain. So I think, yeah, some kind of extension of that strange visual secret third thing would be great.
Yeah, that horizon that's sort of between media or not bound to, like, you know, predictable genre convention seems like a really exciting one, and one that, you know, your work and a lot of the people you work with are already achieving. So it's really amazing to be able to explore it, what you're already doing. You mentioned Escher sentences as a point of inspiration. And so thinking about inspiration and, you know, excitement of the mental and creative capacities, what thinkers are exciting you right now, Mike?
Oh, man. So I wrote these down because the names are daunting otherwise. But so the first one is, there's this really cool book called Intraspace by Christina Jarnik and Wolfgang Schepeler that kind of coincides with the exhibition of the same name, also called Interspace. And it was this kind of not digital, not physical, but kind of in-between space they had made, in which they had a model that was kind of being viewed by a set of cameras from different angles and wearing kind of certain hardware that they were being recreated in real time in kind of digital space as they were moving through the physical. And I find that as like a very interesting form of like the cyborg that I think is more kind of viable. I think the kind of 80s, 90s cyborg is this kind of like mechanical engineering feat of prosthetics and kind of like whizzing little wires and doodads and all that. But I think the kind of more realistic, at least of our time, cybernetic would be this kind of like both online and offline existence, like the IRL while also being virtual. And I find that their kind of approach to that in Interspace is really compelling. I also really loved Geiste Kinsinatite and Elaine Tam's essay Spills in the first volume of the Deleuze zine. They're kind of framing language as this kind of textile praxis, thinking of it as more of like a material within the book structure. And I like that kind of shift from words on a page to words as part of the construction that makes up the page. It becomes this more kind of architectural or even like engineering feat that kind of spatializes writing in a really nice way. It's like I want to see like a utilitarian poetics or like a green architecture of the book or like textual like brutalism, some kind of like mashing of those, I think would be really interesting. B. Oakley, who runs Genderfail Press, released a book called Imperfect Archiving, Archiving as Practice for a Love of Softness, which kind of plays with this middle ground between book and zine, and it discusses the importance of queer archiving. And there's this line later in the text that I think kind of summarizes it well, which is to bear is to hold, to witness, to care for, and to present. And I think it highlights the ways that these books can function more as an accessible kind of art, which I think accessible art often gets framed as like art that's easier to engage with, which I think is stupid. I think that accessible art, I want to be like art that you can literally get easier access to. Like I want it to be easy to acquire, which I think is something that Genderfail does well. I think that dumbing things down or making them more approachable is belittling. Often I find that like people are trying to be quote unquote like approachable to working class, and that's by pretending that they're cavemen and not real human beings. And like I know you, like they're not stupid. Like we're like, you can give someone a book and they'll understand it. To like view accessibility that way, I think is so so belittling and so shitty. And so I like that idea of accessibility as literally giving people the like ability to get their hands on something. That's the cool thing about books in the art realm, is it's so kind of cheaply reproducible compared to other forms of art. And like when you get a copy of a book, it's not a facsimile. It's not like, oh, a recreation of this piece of art. Like, it is the true copy, regardless of what copy you have. And I think that's kind of one of the most compelling things about the material object that is the book. And then most recently today, even, I finished this book called Vermis One by Plastiboo, is what they go by, which is this book that is framed as like a guide to a tabletop game, but is not really a game you can play. It's kind of this like haunted, like dark fantasy adventure book that's hopeless and weirdly obsessed with goblins and more obsessed with the kind of objects that occupy the world than the actual narrative. It's more kind of in the nature of being a quote like a official guide to this world. It's telling you the objects and the like spaces and these floor plans and the kind of creatures that occupy that space, rather than giving you some named character to follow. And I like that kind of ability that game booklets have to kind of create a space for you to wander in, rather than a narrative for you to kind of pull the thread of.
Oh yeah, that's those all sound incredible. And so many right different directions I think that you're kind of pointing towards. I really like both like this way of thinking, rethinking the labeling of accessible art as something just that, yeah, people can get their hands on, right? As or a thing that people can like directly interact with, which is rarely the way that it's being used. And then just maybe to slightly shift into thinking about these like game spaces as just like places to be spending time and wandering and collecting information, right? Without this like really clear kind of guided direction. I think like maybe is a helpful way of thinking about the ways in which we attend to our time and space that we are allotted. And makes me think of our, yeah, the other Paul Thek question we have, which I think of as a companion to the what is waste, but what is leisure?
So I originally had put, my first answer was it's the brief moment between falling asleep and being asleep, and that everything else is labor. But I think my real answer would be, I mean, it's supposed to be the time you're not working, right? I've tried to recently introduce like non-screen time into my schedule because, you know, I work on a computer all day and the art kind of stuff I do is on the computer all day and the freelance is the computer all day. And so I've been trying to kind of add these kind of more, not prevalent, but kind of noted parts to my day that it's like, I'll just cook in the kitchen, or I'd mentioned earlier that I started building furniture recently, and so I made like a bookcase and a desk, and most recently I made a, and I don't know why for the life of me, but I made a 130 pound concrete end table because I thought it would be cool, but I didn't think about having to bring it up to the apartment on the second floor when I made it. But so I think it's like these non kind of, I mean, to an extent it's all labor, but I think things that don't feel like labor that I'm incorporating into the day, because there's both the labor I enjoy doing, the labor I'm forced to do to stay alive. And so things that fall outside of those two realms, I think, are maybe leisure, you know, spending time with people I like, or making jam out of persimmons, or listening to like a Sedan Archives album. Like those moments that don't feel like I have to do them, but I'm just doing them because I want to, not out of like compulsion like art is, or out of monetary kind of necessity like work is. Or that first answer is good too, I think.
They're all good. And also, I'm deeply upset that Vermis One is sold out now that I know about it.
That's crazy, because I ordered it just like a week ago. So that's, oh man, I just snuck in there, I guess.
You got it. Well, and you've also provided me a segue. I was flailing around trying to think of one to our final question, which is our greediest question. You mentioned the Sedan Archives album. So I'm just really curious, what have you been listening to lately?
Oh, man, it changes a lot constantly. I have this habit that I tend to listen to albums instead of like making playlists. And so recently it's been, there's this band called Fiveless Glock, has an album called God's Trashmen Sent to Write the Mess, which is this like French American smooth, chill, like jazzy kind of music. It's kind of like this bilingual middle ground and like very fun. They toured with Stereolab recently, so kind of a similar vibe to that. But then also I tend to jump all over the place. So like I'm In Your Walls by Death Insurance is this like angsty, hyper online, like hyper pop album that I love that has maybe the dumbest line in a song that I've ever heard, but I love, which is "Eat my shit because I finish what I started." It's like just in the middle of one of the songs and I fucking crack up every time. And then LP by JPEG Mafia is great, just like hyper aggressive, like leftist online kind of rap. And then I really like pretty much anything Billy Woods is involved in. He's a kind of like very left-leaning, like semi-political kind of rapper. He had a solo album called Aethiopes that's really good that opens with this kind of bizarre track about like a house that no one can leave, almost in this like Edgar Allan Poe way. But he also is half of this duo called Armand Hammer, who made an album that I love called Haram that's just full of crazy lines. Like there's one that's like, your crew is fragile as the Balkans is, or there's another that's like, you got to kill the cop in your head, and all of these like great kind of lines that I tend to like really hang on to anytime I think of them. But there's that there's a lot that I go back to too. I cycle back to Nala Sinfro's Space One, which is a really kind of mellow, almost ambient jazz album. Or Mock Homie is this Haitian rapper who has a great album called Dollar Menu that's just, it opens with a There Will Be Blood, like kind of soundbite. Or Dijon has this album called Absolutely. It's just like raw emotion, kind of like really sparse, kind of instrumental, and even the audio quality is kind of shit on purpose at times, which I love. And I feel like I'm constantly revisiting Sun Ra's Fireside Chat with Lucifer. I can just sing Nuclear War all day and sound like an idiot, but it's changing all the time. It's usually some kind of weird rap or kind of hyper pop. I know the new 100 Gex just came out, but just a lot of like very goofy, distracting stuff.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Your crew is as fragile as the Balkans is just an incredible line and range of reference. I mean, yeah. That's incredible. Mike, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Can you let our listeners know where to find your work if they want to check it out?
Yeah, so you can find my personal work at mikecreo.com, and that just has, you know, all my writing, links to all the books, links to any design services if you got anybody wants to work with me on books. And then cloak.wtf is the URL for Cloak, which is that interdisciplinary publishing project. I have a book coming out soon from Astrophil called Leopold's Labyrinth that, you know, should be out by the summer. And yeah, thank you so much.